I'd like to reintroduce Dr. Fitzgibbons, who can come talk and maybe tell us whether or not we need to do or mitigate some of our risk by not fixing all the inguinal hernias.
Thanks.
Thank you. Well, that certainly is one strategy to not have to do any preoperative testing, just don't do the operation. I had to use my own computer for this one because there's a little bit of corruption in the one that I gave him back there. Now if I can just get this to... Okay, so... this is my next to last talk today, and it's on a subject that's pretty near and dear to my heart because we've been involved in some multi-center and national trials dealing with this subject, and I'll kind of explain how that all came together. Oh, got the wrong one. This is Paddy O'Dwyer that I'm showing in this slide. He's a surgeon from Scotland. And he's been very influential in a lot of the work that's been done to show the natural history of an inguinal hernia and to know and why watchful waiting probably is a reasonable strategy for a certain subset of patients. He has a large clinic in Scotland and has been able to use the data from the patients that he has there to make many very useful observations pertinent to this talk. So this is the first paper I want to discuss, pain from primary inguinal hernia and the effect that repair has on that pain. And what he did was to take his patients and have them use a visual analog score between 0 and 100, and he classified the patients into having either no pain or very mild pain, meaning a visual analog score of less than 10, and then he tested them both at rest and in activity. And in his group of patients, you can see that vast majority of patients, not the vast majority, but a substantial number of the patients, the majority of the patients, have really minimal or no symptoms, even at rest or at activity. So the problem is when you do an inguinal hernia repair, you obviously drive some of these patients from the mild category into the moderate and severe if they suffer a complication of post-herniorrhaphy pain, and that can be a real problem. It's not too many, but when it happens, it's not so good. And even at activity, now activity is where you get the most benefit. People that have pain at activity obtain the most benefit from inguinal hernia repair because you drive so many of them into the mild and moderate situation. But still, there is a substantial number that get driven the other way. They get driven into the severe pain form. Pain level scores higher than 10, which is more than they had preoperatively. So the conclusion, according to him, is that watchful waiting is a good strategy for patients that don't have any symptoms. It's a no-brainer, if it's safe. So what's critical here is to understand something about the natural history of an untreated inguinal hernia. It's because safety is our most important concern. And what is the thing that we're concerned about? It's, of course, it's the dreaded complication of a hernia, that is a hernia accident, which is defined as either strangulation or a bowel obstruction. So O'Dwyer looked at his data relative to this, to the problem of incarceration and strangulation. And he first noticed that the probability of becoming a hernia that's asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic becoming painful is quite high, 90% by 10 years. And you'll see this is going to bear out in some future studies that I'll discuss in a few minutes. But even though 90% of the patients had pain, 30% of the patients actually developed an incarceration also. But there was minimal morbidity with this problem. Leisure activity was affected in only 29%. Only 13% of the employed patients had to take any time off of work because of hernia-related symptoms. And as far as incarceration is concerned, remember, incarceration is not synonymous with the complication. Many people develop chronically incarcerated hernias without any symptoms. But 10 of the patients did suffer acute incarceration requiring treatment, but only two of them had any compromised ischemic material, one with infarcted small bowel, one with infarcted omentum, out of 699 patients. And there were no deaths or serious complications. So who cares? We shouldn't have to worry about this dreaded complication. It's perfectly reasonable to observe these patients. Well, we certainly do care about the strangulated hernia, and so we need to do something to identify these patients if we're going to consider a watchful waiting strategy. Now, I'm going to switch gears here just for a second, and I'm going to talk a little bit about gallbladder surgery. Now, why would I talk about gallbladder surgery in a hernia talk? It gives me the opportunity to give you the background of how we got involved with studying natural history, because I'm primarily a biliary tract surgeon. So, as you know, laparoscopic cholecystectomy came on the scene in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and the Committee on Emerging Technology at the American College of Surgeons recognized that there was a lot of harm done to the population of the United States by the way that procedure was rolled out, basically in weekend pig courses with the surgeons having cases lined up the next week after they took their pig course the weekend before. And this resulted in a substantial number of injuries and not considered to be a great success by many people. So since conventional inguinal hernia repair has about the same incidence in this country as gallbladder, in other words, about 750,000 a year, there was a lot of people that felt that a laparoscopic method would be applied to hernia very quickly. These are the serious interabdominal injuries that were caused with laparoscopic cholecystectomy, major vascular injuries, visceral injuries, common duct lacerations, small bowel obstructions due to adhesions. All of these were complications that concerned many people. Well, the college became aware that I was doing a randomized controlled trial of laparoscopy. We had gone to the lab and developed some techniques to do a laparoscopic herniorrhaphy, and as a matter of fact, the terms TAP and TEP all came out of that that work. We assembled this group of experts here. You can see a lot of Nat Soper, John Hunter, Dave Ratner in this picture, and we were so confused about what we couldn't stay on the same page because we didn't know whether we were in the preperitoneal space or we were doing it totally extraperitoneal. So we came up with those terms, TAP and TEP, and that's where they came from. But anyway, the college had asked me to sponsor a trial comparing laparoscopic herniorrhaphy with conventional herniorrhaphy because we wanted to make sure that this procedure was rolled out safely this time. We didn't want to see the kind of injury we saw with laparoscopic cholecystectomy. In our discussions with the NIH and with the Agency of Healthcare-Related Quality of Life, who eventually funded the study, it became obvious that they weren't interested in this simple study of laparoscopic hernia versus regular. They told us that industry could fund that because it has so much bearing using prosthetics and this stuff, like, has so much interest to industry. Well, we didn't want to have it funded by industry. And so in talking to our health economists, it soon became obvious that if we added an arm of watchful waiting, observation only for the asymptomatic patients, that they might become very interested because that could save them money. So we came up with a trial like this. This was the original design of our trial. It was two-armed. If the patient had no symptoms, then observation versus laparoscopy versus conventional was going to have to be studied. It was going to be in the protocol. obviously the patients with symptomatic hernias couldn't have observation. Well, that design was thrown out by the NIH because it was too complicated. So it was a double-edged sword. So we had no choice but to split the trial into two parts. One was the watchful waiting trial, one was the L-scope versus Lichtenstein trial. One was went to the VA because by this time we had gotten the VA interested into the in this study. So we were seeking funding from both NIH and from the VA Cooperative Trials Group. And the only problem we had with this is the VA absolutely insisted that they do the laparoscopy. They wanted to do the laparoscopy trial, not the watchful waiting trial. And we fought with them tremendously because we felt that the lap versus open study would much better be done in the private setting, because we had assembled a group of both private and university surgeons, as you'll see in a minute, to do one arm of the trial. But the VA absolutely insisted, and that's been a mistake which I regret to this day, because the biggest criticism of the VA trial of laparoscopy versus open is that the surgeons weren't good enough. The surgeons really weren't trained well enough, and that's why the results were as bad as they were. But anyway, that's digressing. But that's how we got to the point of a watchful waiting trial. So how did we justify doing a watchful waiting trial to the funding agency? Well, the first thing we had to do is try to establish some way of having a probability of a hernia accident, some way of demonstrating what the probability of a hernia accident is, because that would tell them what the scope of the problem was. But it's very difficult to find that information because there's just virtually no groups anywhere in the world where there's whole groups of patients who don't have their hernias operated on. And so you can't get that, and you can't get that natural history. So we had to go to some obscure data sets. And one was Paul Berger's Trust Clinic from the late 1800s. And he kept very good records in his Trust Clinic. Operation at that time was shunned. This was before Bassini. So people didn't do operations. And then we looked at Cali, Colombia, because the government there had decided to do a very detailed study of the of patient population for 1 year. And this gave us some information. This is the information from Berger's Trust Clinic, 1980 to 1984. He had records on 8,633 patients and noted 242 accidents for a probability of 0.0037. At Cali, Columbia, this data came because the government there did actually try to study the entire population, a stratified segment of it, between 1965 and 1966 to look for common conditions. What's the incidence of common conditions such as gallstones, and that included hernias. So that gave us more information, and sure enough, the probability was about exactly the same, 0.0038 per year. So if you plug this into this formula, you can come up with a lifetime probability of a hernia accident of 1.59 for an 18-year-old and 1.27 for a 72-year-old. Now, the reason why the numbers are less in the 2001 column is because people are living longer at that point. That's why the number goes down a little bit. So that resulted in the watchful waiting trial, and it was eventually funded by the Agency for Health-Related Quality of Life, and this was eventually published in JAMA in 2006. But there's actually one other trial that's also been done, very similar to ours, or at least a very similar goal to ours, and that was again by Dr. O'Dwyer, our friend Patty O'Dwyer, that I showed in the beginning of this talk. Now, we showed that watchful waiting is a good option. It's a good option for patients, and I'll explain that in a minute. O'Dwyer's trial was, according to the way he analyzed the data, was not quite as encouraging for watchful waiting. Let me just run through this a little bit. The U.S. trial was a prospective randomized trial with watchful waiting versus Lichtenstein, 2.5-year enrollment, an average follow-up of 3.5 years. We enrolled a total of 753 men, and the budget for this was $5 million, almost $6 million. And you might say, well, why do you have to waste $6 million to look at study a simple condition like an inguinal hernia? Well, it's a five-year study. We had six sites. We wanted to put a full-time coordinator in each institution for the entire time, and that's what you have to do if you're going to accurately collect data. Anybody that's if you depend upon the surgeons to collect the data, it's going to not be of good quality. If you're going to conduct a proper trial, that's the way it has to be done. And that, of course, 5 years, that's a lot of salary, and that's where all the money goes, salaries for employees. So it's a very well-controlled trial because we have objective people collecting the data. So our goals were to determine if watchful waiting was an acceptable alternative for patients with either minimally or asymptomatic hernias. Our primary aim at 2 years was pain interfering with normal activities and the physical function component of the SF-36. Secondary aims were complications, patient-centered outcomes, functional status, cost, and then satisfaction. This was the main result. At 2 years, there was no difference in either pain or physical functioning at 2 years between the two groups, those that got operated and those that didn't get operated. We looked at other aspects in other of that people were concerned about. Is it safe? We only had one hernia accident within the two-year follow-up period, and that was 4 months after randomization in that particular patient. There was one additional hernia accident during the follow-up period. Remember, these people are being randomized throughout the entire five-year period, so the minimum follow-up is 2 years, but some of the patients had more because it's a five-year study. So we had one more outside of the two-year window, but the overall accident rate was very low. We did see a substantial crossover, which we'll talk more about in the later studies, but a substantial number of these people do cross over as they're being observed in the observation side of the study. Now, another concern among surgeons was that delaying surgery would have an adverse effect. Fascial defects would get bigger, and patients would be more elderly and have more comorbidities. So we looked at that, and we looked at 353 patients that underwent the TFR immediately because they were randomized to that side with crossover patients, and there were 65 of those patients, and we didn't see any difference in operative times, complications, recurrence rates, or patient satisfaction in those groups. So it doesn't seem like there's a penalty for delaying the surgery. We also looked at cost, and I'm not going to go into the details because of time of that, but we were able to demonstrate that watchful waiting is an acceptable alternative operation when you break it down into qualities. Now, Patty O'Dwyer, again, I said his trial wasn't as favorable. He published this about a year before we did. And he concluded that the repair of asymptomatic inguinal hernia does not affect the rate of long-term chronic pain, may be beneficial to patients in improving overall health, and may reduce potential serious morbidity. So he was advocating for more routine repair. But when we looked at his data, we kind of looked at it a different way. This is a comparison between the two trials. In the North American trial, 720 patients, only 160 in the O'Dwyer trial. He had an older age group. He only accepted men greater than 55 in his trial, as opposed to we took everybody over 18. Symptoms were, we accepted patients with minimal symptoms. They had to have absolutely none in his trial. He also required that the hernia be visible, and we didn't. If it was detected only by physical examination, they were accepted into the trial. And the crossover rate was higher in his trial. Well, there is some problems with the O'Dwyer study. For one thing, he had to change his recruitment goals because of lack of accrual. Originally, the design was 250, and he had to scale it back to 160, and that's always a problem in this kind of a trial. They were older age group. the overall mortality in his study was 6.25%. Obviously, that's not because of the hernia repair. That's because of the medical comorbidities. And his follow-up was shorter than ours, only 1 year. So this is the way we look at his conclusions. He says it does not affect the rate of long-term chronic pain, so why don't you just go ahead and fix the hernias? Well, we look at it as in the opposite way. Okay, well, if it's the same, why should you fix the hernia and put the patient through the pain of a hernia repair? So we look at it in two different ways. May be beneficial to patients in improving overall health. This was based on the fact that on the intention to treat analysis, there was a consistent trend to improvement of about 5 points in the SF-36. It was a trend. It did not reach statistical significance. So it really is not really a valid conclusion, even though there's a trend there. And then may reduce potential serious morbidity. And this is a quote from the paper. There were three serious adverse events in observation group. One patient had an acute hernia, had a strangulation. One had a postoperative stroke, and one had a myocardial infarction and died postoperatively. And the idea was that maybe if the hernia had been fixed sooner, these comorbidities wouldn't have entered into the scene and they wouldn't have had these complications. But it's hard for me to accept that because this is only a one-year trial. And if you look at the details of the trial, it took 103 days to get even the patients randomized to immediate surgery to actually have their surgery, and that has to probably do with the system in Scotland. And if you look at the operation group, many of these patients died of comorbidities similar to what was seen in the observation group. So I really felt that that was a very weak argument, and that ours was much stronger. Well, anyway, now both of these trials have been updated fairly recently using long-term follow-up data, and this is the update presented last year at the American Surgical of the North American trial. And then just to refresh your memory, the original study ended December 2004. At the end of that trial, participants were invited to a voluntary enroll in a long-term registry on the watchful waiting side. They were questioned by mail, email, and phone if necessary, 5 times during the study period. We had a full-time coordinator that kept track of these patients. The patients from the watchful waiting group were divided. The primary outcome variable was crossover from operation, crossover to operation. Statistical considerations. The univariate analysis were done on baseline medical comorbidities to determine the risk and the result in for crossover. The multivariate analysis using a Cox proportional hazards regression model was carried out for a variable identified as a univariate as having a p-value of less than 4, and crossovers were then predicted using Kaplan-Meier analysis. So results, there were 720 patients in the original study, 366 were randomized to watch for waiting, 254 enrolled in the registry. And the reason why the number is that low is that one of our sites, McGill, refused to let us have access to their patients. They would not, the IRB wouldn't let us enroll them in the registry. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, but they wouldn't. 167 completed follow-up data to the end of the study. 9 died, 3 withdrew consent, and 75 became lost to follow-up at various times during the course of the registry. Patients in the watchful waiting group were significantly younger, more likely to have a chronic cough, and have an alcohol intake of more than 2 drinks per day during the two weeks prior to randomization. That's for the original study. And here was the Kaplan-Meier crossover rate. 67.9 of the patients overall had crossed over by 10 years, as estimated by Kaplan-Meier. More significantly, perhaps, is that the elderly patients who were randomized at age 65 or greater, had an 80% chance of crossing over. So the crossover rate was really much higher than we would have expected. This is just showing this in graphic form. By 50% crossover by 7.5 years. And this just shows the difference in age, greater than 65 and less than 65. Why did the patients cross over? Well, the vast majority crossed over because of pain. 51%, that was the only reason, and in another 30%, there were multiple reasons, but most of them included pain, so almost 80% of the patients crossed over because of pain. Now, O'Dwyer also has recently updated his trial, and his findings are pretty similar to ours. He has a little higher crossover rate. He published in 2011, and his Kaplan-Meier analysis predicted that 72% of the patients would cross over by 7.5 years. Why is the crossover rate higher in the United Kingdom trial? Well, it just probably has to do with the nature of the studies. As we've talked about before, he had an older group of patients, and we've already shown that older patients cross over at a higher rate. And then there were more advanced hernias to begin with, because remember, you had to have a visible bulge to be in his trial, where we accepted smaller hernias. So to summarize, based on a 72% crossover rate at 7.5 years in the United Kingdom trial and the 68% overall crossover rate in the North American trial by 10 years, one would have to assume that the logic is that watchful waiting is not an effective strategy, as with time, almost all men cross over. So this was O'Dwyer's summary. There seems little point in watchful waiting because the majority of patients will require an operation in the foreseeable future. Surgical care for an asymptomatic hernia should be recommended for medically fit. That's O'Dwyer's conclusion. And I'd have to agree with that. I mean, the crossover rate is very high, but there is a few little caveats. The results may not completely apply to the general population of patients with minimally symptomatic hernias, because in both of these trials, the reason why the patients were entered in the trials, they came to the doctor with a concern about their hernia, even though they were asymptomatic. So it's a bit of a subpopulation of patients that came to the doctor for their hernia. Because physicians have been observing elderly patients with hernias for years and without too much problem, without this high of a crossover rate. So the answer may lie in the recruitment process, and that's the point I'm trying to make there. Nevertheless, these two studies provide overwhelming evidence that those patients who choose to attend their doctor's office because of concerns about their hernia, even if they state they have no symptoms, should be told that they have about an 80% chance of requiring surgery, and surgery will almost be inevitable if they're in good health. Why do the older patients have a higher crossover rate than the younger patients? We speculate that the elderly patients might have a tendency to more minimize their symptoms and therefore become eligible for a trial with more symptoms than they really let on to. So routine repair to prevent hernia accident is not necessary, but patients need to be counseled that they probably will end up in surgery. Now, as far as hernia accident is concerned, only 3 patients in the watchful waiting group developed incarceration for which they underwent surgery with no mortality. Similarly, the acute presentation rate was only 2.5 in the United Kingdom trial. It confirms that the finding that the risk of a hernia accident should not be considered an indication for surgery. Older studies in the literature that suggest otherwise, that suggest that incarceration and strangulation is an indication for surgery, can no longer be considered relevant. Limitations of this study, the registry was voluntary, and that may result in a selection bias. The study participants came from 5 different centers across the United States and North America, and Canada. So this may not be representative of the general population. So in conclusion, although watchful waiting for men with minimally symptomatic hernia remains a safe strategy even on long-term follow-up, patients who present to their physician to have their hernia evaluated, especially if elderly, should be informed that they almost certainly will require surgery. Results may not be able to be extrapolated to the broader population of patients who don't come to the doctors with their hernias. some caveats. Be careful with extrapolation. Moderately, we were only studying minimally symptomatic patients or asymptomatic. We can't extrapolate this to these findings to moderately symptomatic patients, and certainly do not extrapolate this to women. Inguinal hernia is a different disease in women, a much higher incidence of femoral hernias, which are difficult to sometimes differentiate from inguinal hernias, and we all know that the risk of strangulation is very high, up to 40% in females with femoral hernias. So certainly this cannot be extrapolated to women. And this is a study that really pointed this out. I discussed this yesterday, a study from Sweden in which 695 groin hernia repairs in women were studied, showing about a 40% acute presentation rate for the subgroup of patients that had femoral hernias with a very high morbidity and mortality. So with that, I'll give up the floor. Thank you very much.